Today's program has been brought to you by 360 Cookware. Their stainless steel cookware uses vapor technology to cook better tasting, more nutritional food. To learn more and receive 20% off, click their logo on our website, heritageradionetwork.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
It is 3 p.m. on Thursday, and that means it's time to meet your maker. This is the show where you do exactly that. I'm your host, Rachel Wharton. I am joined today by my Ed McMahon, John Taggart. Say hello, John.
Hey, how are you?
And our special guest today is Sean Bozinski. Sean, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So many listeners might know Sean as the creator of the Vindies, which are kind of like the primary awards for food trucks, carts, stalls, stands, and street vendors. But that event, which is now being held in L.A. and Philly, is actually a fundraiser for your true passion, which is the Street Vendor Project, which is kind of like a labor union, a membership group, labor union, a group for street vendors. And what I was hoping is you would take us back to when you started it after September 11th, and how the idea crystallized in your head, and how did you start? What was the first thing that you did, and why?
Okay, well, that's a long. That's sort of like my, well, not exactly my life story, okay, but
we can talk about the burrito cart later.
Yeah, that gets to maybe 11 or 12 years now.
Uh-huh.
Basically, I was coming out of law school. I had been a vendor for a short time beforehand, and I realized that there was a real need for some organization to be out there representing and organizing street vendors. You know, this whole population of 20,000 people in our city. And I knew, or I was, you know, savvy enough to figure out that if there was going to be anybody to do it, it would likely be, or it could be me, that I had some special skills coming out of law school. I was going to be a brand new idealistic lawyer, and that I probably had the opportunity to try to raise some money to do the work. In fact, I did, you know, but also that I was that it was very meaningful to me. I had been a vendor. I knew people in the community, and I really cared about the issues. So, you know, that was that. And it did so happen that it was right after September 11th, and so the first actually thing I remember doing was walking around downtown, and it was a couple months afterward. They were letting pedestrians back downtown, but they were stopping food carts at Canal Street.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, no particular reason. I mean, you know, in fact, just like with after Hurricane Sandy, vendors had a special role to play because lots of restaurants and delis were not yet opened up. We needed the vendors,
right.
And yet they were being stopped by the police and who were saying you can't go back to work. So at first we had to broker a compromise with that and get vendors back to work. And
explain why that would be such a hardship to a vendor.
Well, a lot of people think that vendors can just go anywhere, but just like any business, most vendors are working in the same spot every day for many, many years. And vendors are not rich people. They're low income. That's why they're vending. And so if you can't work, you can't make money, you can't support your family, you can't pay your rent, everything that's involved with being able to work. So it's a real hardship, and it was a hardship. And also we noticed, or we quickly saw that many, you know, there were a lot of grant and loan programs for businesses and residents that had been affected by September 11th, and vendors were being excluded from those programs. We would go, and vendors and the programs would say, "Oh, well, you need to provide a lease."
Oh, right.
Well, vendors don't have leases, so that's just that was like a very early example of people just not thinking about vendors, mm-hmm. when they made the rules, and nobody doing anything about it because vendors were not in any position to fight back.
So what's the first thing that you did?
Well, you know, I mean, I spent a lot of time walking around on the street talking to vendors. That's a good thing about organizing vendors, uh-huh. is you can find them. They're out there standing around, and usually they're very, very happy to talk to you. And so in some ways, it's an easy job to go talk to vendors. It's lots of fun. You get to meet a lot of interesting people. I mean, we did lots of things. I remember I got a hold of the list of all the licensed vendors in this from the city, and we sent out a mailing to them kind of announcing our presence. That was one thing. So that generated some buzz and some people coming in the door. But mostly it was walking in the streets and talking to people.
So how long after 9/11 were vendors allowed down below Canal?
I don't exactly remember, but it was within a month or so that we were able to get people back to work. And it may have sort of started in steps. You know, it may have been Canal, and then they may have been stopping people at.
Was there a security issue because of the trucks? Because they were mobile?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, sometimes the police will say that, but vendors are very happy to have their trucks or their cart, searched, and God forbid. So dogs are fine. You can go and look around. It seemed to be, and it was a difficult time. I'm not trying to blame anyone. The reaction was no. I mean, there had just been a huge terrorist attack. The reaction was no, you can't do that.
Because there were a lot of people down there working nonstop 24/7 and nowhere to eat,
True. And there were actually, and ever since then, there's been a lot of construction downtown, which has actually displaced a lot of vendors, made it hard to work in certain parts of downtown. So that's just now finally starting to kind of get back to normal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like a decade later.
Yeah, right.
So those, do some of the vendors go back to their spaces, or they are now in other parts of the city, or?
There were a lot of people that were vending right around the base of the World Trade Center that obviously had to move,
right.
And that whole area, now a construction site, but even around it was declared a no vending zone as one of the political responses by Pataki in 2004. People said this is a sacred site, and that makes a certain amount of sense, but now it's going to be a shopping mall and a couple of big towers, so the whole site is not exactly sacred, but they use almost any reason they can to get rid of vendors.
Now, what was the majority of vendors that were down there pre-9/11?
I think it ran the gamut. I mean, a lot of food vendors, of course. We also have a lot of merchandise vendors in our group. It's not just food vendors. People selling T-shirts and ties and all kinds of things like that, cell phone cases.
I used to work right there at the Trinity Building, maybe until months before September 11th. So I would go eat at them. The ones that were, there's that park where Occupy was. Those were my lunch vendors. They were, that was a different era in street food.
It's
like
true.
The dark, way before anything, like cupcake trucks or whatever. But so you said at that you started getting people in the door. Did you actually have a door at that point?
I did have a door. At first I was planning I would just have to do it out of my apartment or something because I didn't have enough money for space. But I was very lucky to find an organization called the Urban Justice Center, which kind of operates as a cooperative. And says, if you we have space, if you want to do the work and you can raise the money, then come. And so I joined up and I had a little cube in NoHo at the Urban Justice Center, which is still our home for the Street Vendor Project, although we've moved offices.
So do you have more than one cube now?
Yeah, we have a little office. We've got four and a half people.
Wow.
And we have some interns running around, and we need more space because vendors come in every day sometimes.
That's what you were saying. I talked to you once on the phone, you were like, I'm surrounded by my members right this second. So how many members are there?
So we've got more than 1,500 members, all individuals who sell food or merchandise on our streets in New York City. And it's an amazing group of people, as you well know, and it's a lot of fun working with them. We have our meetings take place in six languages simultaneously. I don't know of any other group that does that.
How does that actually work?
It's crazy. It's totally chaotic. We've got some headsets and we have...
Really? It's like the United Nations. That is amazing.
It is. And it slows things down a little bit, as you might imagine, but it's very important that everybody understand what's going on.
Is that 1,500 New York or is that 1,500 Philadelphia, LA, and New York?
No, that's just in New York. We don't have any members in the other cities. Our members exist only in New York, and there are other groups organizing vendors in other cities, in LA and Philly for sure, and we work with those groups, but we haven't yet established offices there.
Well, they have completely different rules, I imagine.
Totally different rules, different cities, different histories, and people, groups in those cities are doing great work on their own, so it's really a privilege to work with them and to put on events with them like the Vendy Awards.
Wait. So, what are the things that you're helping your members do or prevent or achieve?
Well, vendors have all kinds of problems, right? At the most basic level, vendors get about 40,000 tickets every year from the police and the health department. vendors have their stuff taken away from them.
Uh-huh. Where does it go?
It could go anywhere into the NYPD property clerk division. Uh-huh. If you've ever been out to Erie Basin in Brooklyn, where that's where the carts go.
Uh-huh.
It could end up in a warehouse, you know, somewhere. Often it ends up in the garbage or who knows where.
When you say they take their stuff, you mean they're literally their cart or the food that's in it?
Yes.
Wow.
All of the above, yeah.
They can just seize it when they feel like it's they're out of...
They're not supposed to be able to seize it for any reason.
Uh-huh.
There are certain legal reasons and certain times when they are allowed to seize the property.
Like a no-parking zone?
Yeah, there are some times, but often they get a little confused about which times they're allowed to and which times they're not. So that happens. There is harassment from store owners, from residents. There are sometimes planters or benches or other sort of like sidewalk obstructions will get placed in your spot, like the spot that you've worked every day for 20 years, and that's a problem because it pushes you out of your location. Sometimes there's fights between vendors. Sometimes vendors have personal problems. We have an emergency fund that if somebody, God forbid, has a sickness or a death in their family, they can tap. Sometimes vendors need loans to either pay off their tickets or to expand. So as well as individual problems, of course, at our meetings, we talk about what the group is doing to try to advance our cause and try to make changes.
Do individuals come to the meeting and then like and talk about their individual problem, or is that when you're trying to get some groupthink going?
Well, that's a good point. That's actually one issue that we have is sometimes vendors we want to give them a chance to be heard, but sometimes there's no easy solution. So a lot of people talking about their problems, and then it can get kind of depressing. So we try to find ways to direct those problems.
It's because they're probably working so hard, and then when they finally get a chance to release, they just blow up.
It's like an AA meeting.
Yeah,
it is a lot like an AA meeting. We have food, we introduce ourselves, and we try to really build community among the vendors. And it is a chance, I think, for vendors to sort of, you know, to be heard, because all day just people are talking to them, telling them what to do, telling them what they want. And
these are people from like Mr. Softy to like the new hot crepe truck.
Yeah, we do have most of our vendors are immigrants, because most vendors in New York City are immigrants. But we do have a fair number or a few vendors from the fancy new trucks, and they are a really important part of our group.
What was I going to ask? So how do you get to use your law degree?
Oh, yeah, we're in court all the time. On the way over here, I was reading we're going to trial in one of our cases where a hot dog vendor had her cart snatched up, and it's going to go to trial in federal court, and so we have a pretrial order that we're working on drafting. I mean, you know, but apart from that, there's legal education that we do with vendors to try to get them to be able to defend themselves and protect themselves when they get harassed on the street. There are problems with and issues that come up with licenses and permits, legal issues there. You know, being a lawyer, I see things in part through a legal lens, but also we do things related to, you know, you could easily see vending through an economic lens, a food lens that you guys might be interested in, a city planning lens, just a policy lens, because all these, the way that we treat vendors as a city, it's a decision by the public, policymakers, and it's a decision that we all can play a part in.
Does city planning take food trucks or any kind of truck or vendor? Do they take that into account? How do they map it or pay attention to it?
Well, that's actually one of the problems. A lot of other cities are much better at thinking about creating space for vendors, because one of the main complaint we hear is that the vendors are blocking the sidewalk or they're blocking the street, and that's only because no space has been created for vendors, right? And we think it's a great thing. For example, our city has created all these bike lanes,
right?
Because people realized we need space to ride bikes, and that's a great thing. Well, our city also needs space for vendors to be there. It's not fair. They used to be in the street. They got kicked up onto the sidewalk, and now people say there's no space on the sidewalk because there's too many people.
So they were kicked up onto the sidewalk because of the bike lanes?
Well, no. I mean, like back in the 20s, in fact, when there were no cars, vendors, if you look at old pictures, like the old push carts would be
in the street. Yeah.
And then when cars came, eventually there were no room for vendors, and so really that problem, the problem of how we design our public spaces and who our public space is for, is got a lot to do with why and where there are vendors and why we should have vendors in
the
city. No,
the same people that go in and inspect a restaurant, are they the same people that would inspect a food cart?
Same folks. It's the health department.
Right.
They have a different group of inspectors, but it's the same health code, so vendors receive the same violations for not wearing a hat if they're preparing mm-hmm. food, or temperature violations or whatever it might mm-hmm. be. And the fines are the same, which are very high. It's the same. It's the same system, more or less. Yeah.
Did not know that.
So how do those inspectors work? Do they just like, I'm going to go down and hit Battery Park today, and then they just wander around and inspect who they see?
Yeah.
How does that work?
They might have. We always wonder how they choose to go where they go. You know, safe to say, you don't want to be right outside of the health department building,
right?
You know, because if it's like
there's no street vendors there right now. It's like desert.
You can imagine you would get a few visits if you're right there.
I got a job to shoot a restaurant in the Upper East Side, and I was shooting the chef in the kitchen. I was blasting away on the food, and I was taking pictures, and here comes an inspector right in. And wow. The chef had to walk away and had to shut down the kitchen right at 5 o'clock p.m.
Imagine if you were in like a 2-foot
and
cube.
They were like rushing me to get the pictures of the food so I could get out, because they would have got a fine if I was there taking pictures.
Wow. Yeah, I know, it's very hard. And I've heard that like restaurants are sometimes able to sort of like stop the inspectors up front and sort of buy some time while somebody in back, you know, covers up the whatever.
Right.
It's hard
Maybe.
For vendors because you're just yeah. all right out there in the open. So
yeah,
there's nowhere to go.
She actually came down as a customer using the bathroom and then came out of the bathroom. And then just
oh, she did. She snuck in.
She came out of the bathroom and then
they
just
can be,
she
they
just,
look like police detectives.
She undid her jacket.
They wear like
and
their
then
badges.
Walked into the kitchen.
Very sneaky.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to take a very short break. We'll be back with more of Sean Baczynski from the Street Vendor Project on Meet Your Maker.
Today's program has been brought to you by AmeriCraft. AmeriCraft and 360 Cookware are proud sponsors of HeritageRadioNetwork.org. AmeriCraft is an American company, and like Heritage Radio Network, they provide the best. Their 360 Cookware is made of the highest quality ingredients, like United States steel. It is made in the greenest cookware manufacturing plant in the world. AmeriCraft makes great cookware and is focused on improvement. 360 Cookware is their exclusive line. It's a contemporary line of cookware and bakeware intended to let you, the Heritage Radio Network listeners, have a unique cooking experience. Its vapor seal allows food to be cooked in its natural juices, preserving all of the vitamins, minerals, and other nutrients without added water, oils, or fats. 360 Cookware invites you to learn more about how this process works on their website, www.360cookware.com.
Every Tuesday at 12 p.m., you can call food scientist Dave Arnold and ask any question you want.
John from Chicago, you're on the air.
Hey, Dave.
Cooking issues!
Who am I fooling? This is horrible stuff. Without glutamic acid, you die!
It is a matter of taste, but there's a lot more fat in sausage than you think.
Get ahead of the curve. Tune into Cooking Issues every Tuesday at 12 p.m. on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Welcome back to Meet Your Maker. Today we are talking to Sean Baczynski, who created the Street Vendor
Project.
Oh, Sean,
you can totally eat pizza while we're here.
Oh, yes, because we're in the back of Roberta's. Any sounds you hear?
Chewing is allowed over the microphone.
But so you were talking earlier about how one of the reasons you wanted to do this was because you were also a vendor. So tell us, what did you make? So obviously you were really cared about food and cooking it. And this is part of it, too.
Actually, I don't care about food or cooking.
I remember, really, not even, you ran a burrito cart.
I even wonder who that was. Like, I know it was me.
Really? That's hilarious.
I still have, like, pieces of the cart uh-huh. in the crawl space above my closet, so I have proof. But I actually don't care very much about food.
How on earth did you decide to do that then?
Well, I mean, burritos are pretty basic, let's face it. I don't know. You know, black beans, rice, I got the tortillas.
I would say red.
Oh.
Red is better.
Yeah. Well, you see, this was
San Francisco style.
I actually think that I was like, if I would have kept going, I could have sold my concept to Chipotle, because that was basically my idea, was just like roll your burrito right in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
And my cart looked very different. It was basically like a steam table, so there was no walls. It was just a steam table on the street.
Really?
And
did you build it yourself?
I had it built in a sheet metal shop in Chinatown, and they never built a cart before, so that was kind of an interesting process.
Do you remember how much it cost to have it built?
I want to say $5,000, but
that's a lot.
It was, and Sean, how long ago was this?
This would have been 98, the summer 98. Of 98, yeah.
And what did you have to do for a license to get a cart back then?
It wasn't easy. Permits are still very hard to come by because there's a limited number of them. And so what you have to do, what I had to do, is find somebody that will, wink, wink, rent you a permit. And so you got to kind of ask around at the garages and talk to a lot of people, and eventually there'll be somebody who has a permit but has maybe moved on, or maybe driving a taxi cab, mm-hmm. or they don't need it anymore, but they can make money by selling it or renting it to you. So that's what I did.
And do those ever expire?
No, I mean, they expire every 2 years, but you can renew them
easily
to the end of your life.
So that's what people do.
That's what people do.
Sometimes, that's why there's the black market.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes even after they die, the DOH discovered that people were somehow renewing them.
That's pretty awesome.
You know, like family members were maybe falsifying signatures and stuff.
To sell it.
Exactly, because it's valuable. And one of these things can go for 15 or 20 grand now for a 2-year permit.
That's amazing.
It's a lot of money for a vendor.
There's like a company. Well, is Mr. Sofi a company or are they individual trucks?
I think it's a franchise, so I think it's a combination of the two. Like they're owned by individuals, but they have an agreement with the company that they buy product from the company.
Now, do they get blasted just as much as everyone else?
I think it's a good question.
They can move around, right?
That is the model of the Mr. Softy of any ice cream truck. Is you're not too attached to any one spot. So if the ticket people come, you just drive around the block. But they do get hassled.
Moving violations.
Moving violations. And parking violations and vending violations. The ice cream trucks are kind of their own world. They have their own garages, and we have a few members who sell ice cream, but it's a little bit of a different world out there.
Like the Big Gay ice cream truck, you heard of that, right?
I think he
started out by renting someone. He would borrow the truck when they weren't using it, if I recall.
Right, right.
I want to hear more about the burritos.
Yeah, oh. Yeah. So back to the burrito.
You just thought this would be a good way to make money before.
I stole the idea. There was I was up in Boston, and there was a burrito cart up there that was doing really well. And it didn't take a genius to say, "Hey, why don't we have this in New York?" And I was a couple years out of college. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do.
So there were no burrito cars in '98.
There were taco trucks,
of course,
in Queens and places, but nothing that I'm aware of in like Midtown.
Because I know that mid 90s onto like early 2001, there was a huge burrito restaurant craze in New York.
Oh yeah, and almost all of those
there
are
was
gone.
Like a corner burrito joint, like everywhere, you know.
Oh, Burritoville was good.
Yeah. Right, right.
They made their own tortillas.
And you could get the free chips, and then you could just have chips.
Yeah, because there was one. I used to work at the Daily News at that point, and there was one right up the street, and that's what I would do for lunch.
Did it have a cooler filled with 40s?
The Burritoville?
There was a few of them that did. That's You'd walk funny. In, you get Mexican beer in 40s, and then you could like have a burrito. So.
Oh, I used to love Burritoville. Yeah, no, I had to do research on these places because I was trying to develop my burrito, but I don't think they were that good, but, you know, good enough for me to realize I didn't want to be a vendor the rest of my life.
How long did it last?
A summer.
And you didn't do it because you had no inkling that this was going to be your cause.
It was more of a business idea, and I just thought it would be kind of fun, and I wasn't sure if I wanted to go to law school, and I had deferred, and so I was like, what am I going to do? And so I wanted to work for myself. I knew that much.
That's pretty. Yeah. And then you did that right up until you went to law school.
Yeah, I wasn't even sure if I wanted to go to law school, but I tried it for a few days and then I stayed.
Really?
Now, when you were doing your burrito cart, were you fined and were you harassed?
I was not. I never got paid a visit. Now, part of the reason, and I was ready for them too, right? Because obviously, it would have been very different for the health inspectors to have come up to me, as opposed to, like, you know, most of our members who struggle to speak English and understand what the rules are very well, because the rules are all printed in English. But I was ready for them, you know, I was ready. But I never had the chance. I think it was because I kept, like, pretty limited hours. I was there from maybe 12 noon until 2 or 2:30. And also I got lucky.
They still only print the rules in English?
Just in English. And even that, it's difficult to understand some of these rules.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah.
So then you went, but by law school, that was you had a special project that was already, by law school, you were already thinking about these issues.
Well, right? During law school, it occurred to me that this could be like a cool project. Yeah.
What is the average lifespan for a immigrant or anybody? Like, it could be, you know, the newest Bob's Tacos is like the hot spot that everyone wants to eat.
The lifespan of the hipness of a truck?
Lifespan of a truck with fines and harassment and everything else. Like, let's say for a year. Do they even make it through a year, or are they just 6 months, you know?
Well, that's a good question. I think now, like, we're starting to see some of the initial wave of maybe 3 or 4 years ago with the trucks, and some trucks are starting to disappear now. So, and it's funny, I teach a class called Street Food Vending 101, and maybe 2 years ago, that class was full every time.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's, fewer and fewer people are signing up for my class, and I think that it's maybe the reality is starting to kick in as people realize this is not the easiest way. Now, folks have done great, especially folks who wanted to go on and open up brick and mortar, which is a great thing. Sort of using their truck as a marketing platform, as a way to get their name out there and build their presence. But as a day-to-day business, it's hard to make any money on a truck.
And I have a friend who had a restaurant, very successful, or he still has it for maybe 8 years, 7 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And he started a truck maybe a year and a half ago.
Lasted about a day.
And it lasted about a day. And all he does now with
is
the truck
is
move it across the street for alternate side parking.
What happened?
And he just couldn't do it.
It's just so hard. I mean, I was basically not strong enough. Like, I was not tough enough. You know, like pushing that thing every day in the summer heat and getting up every morning and be like, oh, I gotta push this thing again. I gotta make the food. I gotta drag the stuff.
And this was
there.
A truck. All he had to do was put gas in it and hire someone with a driver's license and
but he had to have a cook on board too.
He had to have a cook on board. But I mean, this is a very successful restaurant that has no problems at all ever. And he makes tons of money with the restaurant, but the truck just couldn't hold on. And now he's just getting parking tickets.
I think he also had a hard time figuring out where to take it.
Yeah.
It's a big truck.
Yeah, he went to NYU a lot with it, and I don't know if that was doing any good. But you know what he does with it now? He parks it outside his restaurant when he has a party at the restaurant.
Yeah. It's a pretty truck. I bet it cost a lot of money.
Beautiful truck. Cost a lot of money. A lot of renovation to it. Nothing fancy, but just really cool. It's a Mexican food truck.
So interesting. Yeah. I mean, somebody's going to have to do a book about like a post-mortem of all the ideas.
There's that book that we got. What's it called?
Start a food truck.
Oh, yeah. There are some good books about that. David Weber from the Food Truck Association did a good one.
Is that national?
I don't know.
Sorry.
There's a New York City Food Truck Association, which is sort of like us, but they primarily focus on sort of the fancier, newer food trucks, which are, you know, a little different demographic there than most of our members.
But most of your members, is that really what they do? They only do the trucks for a living? That's it?
Yes.
And because I know some taco trucks that I've interviewed, they're almost 24 hours and people do shifts, so the thing is just there all day long and several different, and they maybe have two or three.
That's the passion, Rachel.
Or like what, you know, the only thing they know how to do.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's hard. I mean, a few people will like drive taxis. Now it's in the winter months, it's hard, right? So you've got a few months where basically there's no use to go out to go to work because you're not going to make any money. So a lot of people will go home to their home countries for a couple months and chill out.
Really?
Yep.
Wow. I did not know that.
Or
that's really interesting.
A few people drive taxis. A lot of people, they just kind of stay home and hang out because, there's just no money to be made.
And we were talking earlier about space and how hard it is for someone to find a place to park. And just in the past 2 years, I see every block in Williamsburg, which is a neighborhood here in Brooklyn, like from like North 4th all the way up to like North 7th or 8th, there are just this flux, like this infestation of food trucks.
Infestation.
What I'm,
but you, really? You, I mean, he likes them.
A good infestation.
And, I love and they're mixed. They're totally like some of them are some of them are new immigrants. Some of them are fancy.
And this is a total mix. This is all year round.
It's gotta. I bet the. It's I bet in the winter.
It's in the summer. It's in the rain. It's in the blizzard. It's in the snow. It's in the hurricane. They were out there during the hurricane.
Wow. I wonder if they're going to be asked to move very shortly. Maybe that's what it seems to happen.
Because there was just one truck. It was called Endless Summer, and that was the only truck.
Oh yeah, we know those guys.
And now it's down on North Third.
Yeah, we know those guys. Mm-hmm. I think they were members at one point. Yeah, good guys. Well, you know, you may have turned us on to a new stretch that we got to go check out.
You should definitely. It's usually Friday, Saturday nights when there's a ton of people along Bedford.
I mean, there's a Thai truck, there's a Thai cart, there's a halal cart, there's a.
They're on the side streets, three or four taco carts,
you know, and they're all really like literally like here's the halal, here's the Mexican truck. They're all right next to each other, and they're all doing busy. They're all doing business.
Yeah, it's actually pretty. And so they put up little benches. It's actually really.
They put up chairs and benches.
Wow, I got to come out to Bedford Avenue.
Yeah, it's cool. They were there,
and it doesn't look like they're really having any problems with. Because every time I stopped by, I didn't see. I mean, there was just lines of people and. They're making money, and the business was great because at late at night, there's only so many things to eat around there. You got pizza and pizza.
Oh, that's one of the differences, perhaps, is that it's a late night scene, so maybe the restaurants aren't upset yet.
Interesting, right? Yeah, I mean, we always say that.
Well, there's so many restaurants, Rachel. So,
but they complain. Know. That's like one of the big problems, right?
Yeah, vendors. You know, vendors are good for a business, is what we always say. They bring people. Give people a chance to, you know, stick around the neighborhood, have some food, and then maybe go back in the bar and have some more drinks or whatever it is.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it would really affect Waynesburg, but maybe like in Astoria, if there was a food truck, like three food trucks outside a restaurant, they would get, like, you know.
Well, then the community business development, that's what happens, you know? Right? It's the community business development boards that get angry about that.
Some restaurant owners and deli owners think that vendors are taking their business, and it just takes some splaining to explain that actually it's different markets, it's different populations of people and different products, and the people that are going inside to sit down at the restaurant are not the ones grabbing the taco and, you know,
right, or they may do both depending on what time of day or what they want.
Exactly.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, so
we haven't gotten to talk about your full. It's a full. You had a Fulbright. You have to go to Africa, right?
Oh yeah, that was
I wanted to hear about what the street food scene is like there. You said it was actually it was even harder for them. I recall
very hard for vendors all around the world, right? Because we're part of this cool group called StreetNet International, and it's a global network of there's vendor organizations all around the world. And I was in Nigeria, where there's not much of a vendors movement, but where vendors just get brutalized. Uh-huh. It's awful. And there's a new governor there trying to clean things up. Sounds kind of like what LaGuardia did back in the 30s and 40s here, right? Trying to modernize.
Right, which is why we got the indoor markets.
Yeah.
And they moved them all inside, right?
Exactly. LaGuardia said that vending, street vending, was not a proper thing to do, that it was backward.
Yeah.
And it was so European, right? And now, of course, we love the European-style markets and you know, green markets and the food markets.
Have you ever met Anthony Bourdain?
No.
Because he is big into street food.
We've asked and we've tried. If anybody out there knows him, or Anthony, if you're listening, we've always wanted to get you to be a judge at the Vendy Awards.
That'd be awesome.
Maybe he would do it at one of the other cities, like LA.
That would be cool. Yeah. You know, he's a busy guy. I think we've actually maybe gotten through to his people once or twice. But
I think it would be a good episode.
Well, he has a heart and a soft spot for vending and for street food. I don't see why he hasn't done it yet. It's crazy.
And everybody says he's a cool guy. You know, people are busy, and we're just a small group of vendors trying to, you know, make some money at the Vendy Awards and trying to raise some attention. And hopefully, maybe, you know, maybe this will be the year.
Yeah.
Where he does it?
Where we get Anthony Bourdain to be a Vendy judge.
This is appropriate because this is a nice segue since we're almost out of time, is that in addition to coming to the Vendys, which is your primary fundraiser, if you're interested in helping with the street vendor project, what are the best things you can do?
So many things. Well, once a month we go out in the street and talk to vendors and recruit them to come to meetings and get involved. And we also are putting together the Vendys. We're putting together another gala event. In fact, we're having a meeting tonight. I guess the best thing is to go to our website, streetvendor.org, and there's a little form there you can fill out. We'll get in touch with you and see what your skills are, what your interests are.
So some, like, you could actually just go out, hit the street, and talk to vendors, which is kind of like food research at the same time.
It is. Yeah, we go. Oh, we get a bunch of people. We go to a different neighborhood, like, every time, and we go out and talk to vendors on a Saturday.
Too?
You can eat.
Good.
Eating is part of it.
You must get a lot of food people.
I thought you were going to say something different, which is that one cool thing about working with vendors is that, like, vendors are always bringing us food.
Right. That was my question. I was like, do people bring what they make to the meetings?
I was going to bring some apples here. I mean, it's a vendor brought us apples today,
that's so nice.
I have we have a huge bag of apples at the office, which I was going to bring. But it's really generous. The vendors are so generous, so we're always stacked with. A mad food at the Street Vendor Project.
So if you're listening and you want to start a food cart, get to know this man.
Right.
Well, yeah, it's not easy. We have a class.
think
twice about it. Yeah, do your research. Sign up for our class and give us a buzz.
Well, Sean, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you guys so much
thank
for
you,
having
yep.
me.
This has been Meet Your Maker. See you next week.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.